You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, RudolfSteinerPress.com in England and SteinerBooks.org in America, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected works, volume 313 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Illness and Therapy, Spiritual Scientific Aspects of Healing. 9 lectures translated by Matthew Barton. This is the last lecture in the cycle, lecture 9, given in Dornach on the 18th of April, 1921. Your own knowledge of physiology and other fields must always inform the details of what I wish to say to you today in relation to eurythmy. This will come about quite naturally, but particularly when examining the kind of spiritual, corporeal process that occurs when we do eurythmy, it is unavoidable that I refer to deeper spiritual and physical relationships. And here I would like to draw your attention to the following. We must initially consider the world process that occurs outside us, whose isolated details we usually only study rather than what is really active within it. Just consider that the earth develops, in fact, from a configuring tendency entering from the planetary sphere and also from what lies still further beyond this sphere. The earth is configured from continually in-streaming cosmic forces that manifest in distinct bodies of force as they radiate toward the earth. In this context, we can regard these cosmic forces, although they can in turn include everything I have previously said about radiating currents, as acting centripetally, and really forming, from without, what exists on and in the earth. It is actually true to say that the earth's whole metallity, all its metals, are not chiefly formed by forces of some kind in the earth's interior, but rather that the cosmos implants them into the earth from without. These forces that work through the ether can be called configuring forces, generative forces, working in from without. They stream in from the planetary sphere, but not from the planets themselves, for then these forces would act centrally, and in fact the planets are there to modify these forces. It is particularly in this context that I would ask you to understand the generative forces. They are met by opposite forces, which in the human being and the earth absorb these generative forces and consolidate them, as it were, gathering them round a central point so that the earth can develop. These can be called the forces of consolidation, see figure 23 below, and plan on page 120. Within us, they are present as forces that shape and model the organs, whereas the other forces, the generative forces, are those which tend more to push the organs into the physical world, from the spiritual etheric world. This is a process we can gain a tangible sense of in the contrast between the pushing forces of magnesium and the rounding, shaping nature of fluorine forces. Once again, though, this process is one that comes to expression everywhere. It appears in the teeth from below upward, rounding and shaping above, but also from front to back, and from back to front, from above downward, and rounding off below. You can gain a further tangible sense of this process, for instance, if you picture pushing a spherical shape forward from outside in, so that a form arises, and oppose this with a sphere-forming process that works from below upward. See figure 24. Inside the form, between these two processes, you will now find a mediating element in processes of secretion, and then again the absorption of what is secreted by other processes, and so forth. We can call all this secretion in the broadest sense, for ultimately absorption depends on inward-directed secretion, which is in turn reabsorbed. In between, again, there lies what one can best describe as processes of elimination. You can, again, get a fully tangible sense of an elimination process of this kind. If you imagine that on the one hand, we have something that continually seeks to excrete carbon, and on the other something that absorbs it again in carbon dioxide formation through forward respiration. Then, an elimination process of this kind continues there in a downward direction, and descending still further into the process of metabolism and limbs, you have a consolidation process proper. But this consolidation process is also present in the other direction. In the eye, EYE, you can trace this again and get a fully tangible experience of it. The eye is formed from outside inward. We find this already in embryology, but is consolidated from within. What is formed is then internalized, and the genesis of the eye depends on this. It is internalized so that in sensory perception, we have this consolidation process as we advance toward soul and spirit in us, and thus to organs of spirit and soul, to the sense organs, in what is really an ensouling and spiritualizing process. In a sense, this is the descending process ultimately leading to organ formation. Then at the lowermost end, we have the process of sensory perception, the perception of objects. If this forms and develops further toward consolidation, sensory perception becomes conscious in meeting consolidation and becomes imagination. When imagination develops further and becomes conscious in approaching the elimination process, it becomes inspiration. And when inspiration develops further toward the generative process and comes up against this process to become conscious, thus penetrating it with vision, it becomes intuition. One can develop this sequence of soul life from object perception to imagination, inspiration, and intuition. Generative forces, intuition. Elimination processes, inspiration. Consolidation, imagination, sensory perceptions. But this process we develop in the soul realm also underlies the process of development and growth. As you can see here, it is merely the reverse of the developmental process. We encounter what has finished developing and ascend again in the reverse direction into growth. Generative shaping goes in a descending direction. We ascend in the reverse direction, going to meet growth, so that what we develop as sensory perception and faculties of cognition in imagination, inspiration, and intuition is always counteracted by creative forces that come to expression in the generative forces, the processes of elimination and consolidation. From this you will see that in the human organism, we have the reverse direction of creative, originating activity, into which we enter when we raise ourselves to active cognition. You will gather from this that it is really true to say that what we achieve in imagination involves the same forces that are active without our conscious participation in phenomena of growth, in formative development. When we rise to inspiration, we approach the forces that inspire us from without in breathing, that structure us as we breathe, informing the shaping forces and in a sense permeating and configuring them. And when we rise to intuition, we are really ascending to the agent that enters into our plastic forms as substantial entity from the world outside us. So, here we see the human being as he is shaped out of the cosmos. And if we now apply the insights we have acquired through study of such things as anatomy or physiology, and cast light on them through what is given here, we can start to understand the organs and their functions. We can understand the organs and their functions as if we see... We can understand the organs and their functions if we see that what always works to shape and form us, what normally, as it were, entirely shapes and configures us, lives on the other hand as its other aspect. Recall yesterday's lecture to understand this. In consonant movements which invoke unconscious powers of imagination, as I said yesterday, in a kind of streaming through the organism. So here you can understand how consonantal eurythmy engages with inadequate generative forces in us, deficient shaping forces, and guides them into the right kind of plasticity. Let us consider a child in whom this shaping activity is inadequate, in whom this shaping plasticity is too strongly proliferative. This means that this shaping activity is centrifugal, and by virtue of this, makes the head large. In doing so, this activity prevents the head from imbuing itself with imaginative powers in the right way. These powers must be brought to bear, and so the child should do consonantal eurythmy. A question was asked about a 2-year-old, otherwise healthy boy, with a large head, but not hydrocephaly. In consonantal eurythmy, when properly applied, you do indeed have a means to counteract this and remedy it. Here we come to the point where a thorough observation of morphology, the deeper aspects of morphology, shows that eurythmy treatment is indicated. Another question was this, quote, a boy aged 12 3/4 whose growth is noticeably retarded, no appreciable disease, but suffers with intestinal worms, intelligent but easily tires of mental effort, close quote. This is an extremely interesting syndrome, and all the symptoms point to a deficiency of imaginative forces and a proliferation of shaping organ forces due to insufficient inner shaping forces of the soul. These shaping forces of the soul, of soul plasticity, are also what destroy parasites. It is not surprising, therefore, that a lack of these forces manifests as worms. One should have him do consonantal eurythmy to address this condition. These syndromes will directly indicate where you should intervene with eurythmy, even if such signs and symptoms appear in a somewhat concealed form. Eurythmy can still have an extremely valuable effect, especially when we also address the condition through medicinal therapy. For instance, an interesting question has been submitted to me. Naturally, I will have to respond to it in principle only. If complications develop, special note could be taken of them in a specific instance. But even if the condition in question is associated with other symptoms, from one perspective the characterization I will give here is accurate. Quote, I have a 5-year-old patient who sustained a bullet wound during public unrest and lost a great deal of blood. 2 years ago, a deformity of the joints set in, conditions which later led to anemia and such like in adults. How should I address this situation therapeutically? Close quote. Here you have a joint deformity in which the forces of plasticity are already working outward, are no longer able to remain within, and instead radiate outward, departing from the patient rather than acting internally. Using consonantal eurythmy will make these forces radiate back in the most decided way. In consonantal eurythmy, you see, you invoke active, objectively active imaginations which correct the deformities. In future, as the question already correctly suggested, people will show an increasing tendency to all kinds of deformity, since they will no longer be able to form a normalizing human figure through forces that are involuntarily active. Human beings will become free, gradually also in relation to the configuring of their own form. but will then have to develop the capacity to make use of this freedom. In other words, they will have to learn to engender imaginations that invariably counteract deformity. Now, on the other hand, besides a lack of objective imagination, we may also find here a lack of objective inspiration, which manifests, if I can put it like this, in a deformity of the rhythmic system. This deformity of the rhythmic system arises particularly where objective inspiration, which passes inward, fails to engage with the circulatory rhythm in the right way. We can exert a normalizing effect here if we use vowel eurythmy. This vowelizing eurythmy, you see, acts upon inner irregularities which are not accompanied by morphological changes, in the same way that consonantal eurythmy works upon deformities or a tendency to develop them. I have said previously that it can, however, be necessary to provide additional support if something like this appears in an especially radical form, as in the joint deformities we have just been discussing. Here we need to enlist therapy to aid the process of consonantalizing eurythmy, which works through imagination in particular, by stimulating the inner respiration of organs lying in an inward-oriented position from outside in, beyond the intestinal wall, that is, the lungs, kidneys, liver, and so on. When we do consonantal eurythmy, then the occiput, lungs, liver, and kidneys especially begin to sparkle and emit sparks. This really is something that shows the reaction, the soul and spiritual reaction to what is performed outwardly in the consonantal forms. In these organs we become an entirely luminous being, and the movements externally performed here are always met by movements of luminosity within us. With certain consonantal movements in particular, what I would call an entire luminous reflection of the kidney's process of elimination arises. In this luminous process, in a sense, we obtain an image of the whole elimination process of the kidney, which arises there through consonantal eurythmy. And then this works over into the unconscious imaginations, and the whole process, where this part starts shining, is the same as the one I described as subject to the influence of cuprum. It is the same process. And here we can point out to the physician that there are, of course, people with certain forms of disorder, such as those I had a glimpse of yesterday, at least from a certain perspective, when shown some drawings that had been admired. I was shown these painted designs and asked whether they testified to special esoteric qualities. In a certain sense, of course, they do show esoteric qualities, but it is very difficult indeed to talk to people about these things, for they are in fact objectively rendered kidney luminosity, objectively fixed renal elimination. In this process of renal elimination, when it becomes luminous in certain people of abnormal disposition, and when therefore a certain stasis or stoppage occurs in renal elimination, thus a pure metabolic disorder, the kidneys begin to shine. And when this special interned clairvoyance develops, people start drawing like mad. Such drawings are lovely, always lovely in an outward formal sense. The colors are always beautiful. Of course, though, people don't like it if you say, yes, that's lovely. But in fact, it is your blocked renal elimination. I can assure you that blocked renal elimination and restrained sexual longings, which in a certain way also culminate in metabolic irregularities, are depicted by those with an especially mystical bent, and presented as profoundly mystical drawings and paintings. We should regard many of these things as these kinds of things as symptoms of morbid abnormalities that people are only just managing to live with. Anthroposophically oriented spiritual science, you see, is not mysticism as many people understand it. for it does not entertain any illusions about things such as those I have just described. On the contrary, it undertakes research into these things. But people hold this against you. They hold it against me that I have gone so far in public lectures as to intimate, in this case in relation to poems rather than painting, that the beautiful poems of Mechthild of Magdeburg or Saint Teresa are images of inspired reflections of processes that arise through suppressed sexuality. Naturally, people take it amiss when I characterize someone like Mechthild of Magdeburg or Saint Teresa in this way. These are individuals with a pronounced sexuality, which they held back, suppressed, precisely because it was too strong. In consequence, certain processes of metabolism and circulation arise, which these individuals react to by capturing and fixing them in very beautiful poetry. Yes, viewed from a higher perspective, the phenomenon leads very deep indeed into the secrets of existence. But one has to raise oneself up to such a view. And therefore, we have to have some intimation, at least, of these singular processes, which shine out as inner processes when the outward movements of eurythmia are performed, and notably when what has been mysteriously infused into poetry is performed in eurythmy, as I demonstrated yesterday, when a fine poem is first read out and then appropriately performed in eurythmy, as we saw yesterday, either in consonantal or vowel mode, then this interlaces with the other aspect, so that an inner silent speech comes to meet what is outwardly performed in eurythmy movements. And if the process is not overdone in sensual poems, but when rather it acts as accompaniment, the process of eurythmy accompaniment to beautiful poems, then what occurs in a person is no longer a mapping of pseudo-mysticism, but instead a real healing process. We can therefore say that by getting a patient to perform eurythmy movements, in which he is urged to be awake, to listen and to attend fully to the speech sounds he hears, the whole phrasing of the lines, we enable him to rise to the external generative forces, the objectively intuiting forces. And it will be very good, especially with children and adolescents, to repeatedly urge the person doing eurythmy to attend very clearly to what he hears outside him. This acts on all that remains within us as residue of what materialism calls genetic inheritance, rather than what has unfolded between birth and death. A great part of this, in fact, is what we bring with us from pre-existence in soul and spirit, and by this means we can work on congenital defects, flaws, and such like. By attending carefully in this way, we can dissipate all the tendencies to fixate inwardly on what seeks to emerge in things like mystical drawing or poetry. Eurythmy of this kind responds, after all, to a beautiful, externally spoken poem, and is the reverse process. A true mystic knows that an abnormality reflected in something beautiful is always partially suspect. By contrast, when we inwardly experience something that is beautiful in the external world, then we cannot say that this presents itself to us in an especially magnificent, beautiful form. On the contrary, it becomes schematic, abstract, but abstract like a drawing, in the same way a drawing is abstract. But that is precisely its therapeutic aspect. That is what we want and seek. You see, if Mechthild of Magdeburg, for instance, had been able to do eurythmy to good poems, then she could have avoided her whole destiny as a mystic, and this whole historical saga would not have occurred. Arriving at this point, of course, we can say that good and bad cease in a certain way. This is the amoral sphere of Nietzsche, beyond good and evil. And of course, we should not be so Philistine as to suggest rooting out every Mechthild of Magdeburg. On the other hand, though, you can be quite sure that the supersensible worlds will take good care, as long as people do not let such things run riot, that appropriate relationships with the supersensible world are maintained. Now, I would like to try to clarify a few things, although we are running out of time. Firstly, I would like to respond to this question. Quote, would it not be possible to support therapeutic eurythmy exercises with rational breathing exercises? This would not have to turn into hatha yoga. Close quote. Well, I'd like to say the following here. Rational breathing exercises to support eurythmy exercises can only be handled in the following way in our era, given that human nature is proceeding ever further in a certain direction. You will find that vowel-based eurythmy in particular will tend to alter the breathing rhythm. You can discern this. And now we are faced by the uncomfortable fact of avoiding cut-and-dried rules, generalized dictates about what should or shouldn't be done. Instead, we should first observe what needs to be done. In each individual case, we need to observe this change in breathing of someone we wish to help, depending on his particular symptoms. And then we should draw his attention to continuing this tendency consciously. You see, we are no longer constituted like the ancient Orientals, who could pursue the opposite path, breathing in a prescribed way to influence the whole human being in turn. This will invariably lead to inner jolts when prescribed or laid down in a particular way, and this ought really to be avoided. We have to learn to observe what eurythmy teaches us, in particular what vowel eurythmy teaches us about its influence on the breathing process. And then we can consciously continue what occurs individually as someone does eurythmy. Here you will certainly find that this process, this breathing process, can be continued in a certain individualized way. In other words, in a different way for each person. Well, my dear friends, this is more or less as far as I can go now in answering questions. Due to the lack of time, there is no real opportunity to discuss various things that have been left out. To conclude, I just briefly like to say, my dear friends, that you will have to be prepared for your medical colleagues to join battle with you the moment they realize more clearly that our approach is making some headway. You will need the conviction and persistence to dispel what you are bound to meet. The opposition you meet should naturally never cause you to neglect these things, but nor should we be under any illusions about the kinds of antagonistic forces we invoke. Now the course is ending, I would again like to say that in order to make it possible for the movement to be inaugurated in the right way in the field of medicine, I will always abide by the principle of not taking a direct hand myself in therapeutic processes with patients. I will be on hand to discuss, consult, and advise physicians, and you will always therefore be able to reject any unjustified intervention of mine in your medical work. I said the same thing at the end of the last course. This can be very difficult for me. I can't pretend otherwise, since anthroposophists look for this kind of intervention from me and make all kinds of unreasonable demands. It is certainly true to say that anthroposophists, too, find it difficult to surmount their egotism. Sometimes, in fact, they can become even more egotistic than ordinary folk, and can even regard the greater good of the movement with complete and utter indifference. It is to the benefit of the movement, when nothing is carried out in individual instances, that the external world can regard as quackery, but that instead the whole of medicine undergoes a process of healing, undisturbed by any individual demands associated with personal aspiration. This can get very difficult. But we must maintain this direction, for in this field we will only make headway if we can publicly demonstrate something that is also true of the wider movement, in so far as it is governed by proper understanding, and not distorted by those who fail to understand it. Simply by knowing what is happening in the anthroposophical movement, we have to be able to say that something held against us is definitely a lie, is quite certainly invented. In certain cases, we must simply be able to repudiate such things, and we can do so if we are, as it were, inwardly initiated into all that is involved in stating, as I have said here, that I myself do not intervene directly in healing processes, but that treatment of patients, medical work, is instead carried out by the physicians who work within our anthroposophical movement. Having said that, all I wish to add is that I hope that what I have presented here in this course, often only hints and intimations due to the lack of time, will work on in you and come to due fruition for humanity's benefit. I hope that we will have an opportunity to continue in some form what we have now twice begun. Let us really try to do so. With this wish, I will now conclude these observations, my dear friends, and I hope that our actions will correspond to our wishes in all these respects. I was very pleased to see you here, and it will be a very satisfying feeling to look back on these days that you have dedicated to enriching medical knowledge. The thoughts in which we are united will accompany you on the paths that lie before you, my dear friends, as you seek to put into action what we have tried to first elaborate here in thoughts. That is the end of Lecture 9 and the end of the book Illness and Therapy, Spiritual Scientific Aspects of Healing. 9 lectures given to physicians and medical students in Dornach between the 11th and 18th of April, 1921, including Rudolfsteiner's notes for the lectures, translated by Matthew Barton, introduction by Andrew Mendel, M.D., and Matthew Barton, Rudolfsteiner Press, Collected Works, Volume 313.